on. We're just going to give it a few more minutes to just allow some people that have flagged that they might join us online to give them a little bit of a minute. We'd just like to say hello to colleagues at Winchester, John, Daniel, and to Wes, who's joining us from Berlin. We're here at Kubu, a cameo tone in Finland, and this is the hybrid conversation that's part of the Garden and the Hedge. We have some colleagues also in the room and artists who are participating in the program. So just to say hi. Today's conversation will be with curator and educator Sarah Roberts, who's here physically with me. And we'll just start in a few moments. We just ask that people mute their microphone online and turn off their video. And also that if you have a question, to pop it into the chat. But broadly, the way that we run the session is a little bit like a conversation, like a podcast. So it will be between myself and Sarah, and we will be flowing then into a series of show and tells and tour of the exhibition after this conversation with our colleagues that are in the room here in Finland. So that's just a little bit of housekeeping. In a sense, the session will be recorded, audio recorded, for the purpose of the archive. That's what the record sign is on for. If there's any objection, I hope not, but let us know. But it will not be distributed publicly for the now. We're just going to give it one more minute and then we will kick off. Hi, Ryan. Nice to see you. We're just asking people that join just to, and Anna, just hello, hi, welcome. Just to mute your microphone and your video. We've just gone through a little bit of housekeeping. You haven't missed anything. This conversation is a hybrid conversation where Sarah and I are beaming in from Cameo in Kubu, sorry, Arts Culture Centre on the island of Kemiotone in Finland, which is by the archipelago between Sweden and Finland. We're here speaking about work in relation to the Garden and the Hedge, which is the program that is the summer exhibition for Kubu, 3 months running from June to the end of August, workshops and exhibition and conversation program and many other things. We've also had residency program as well, and I can drop the link in the chat so that you have a sense of it. And so, yeah, we're just asking if people can mute and turn off their video. The conversation will be held as a bit like a podcast. So Sarah and I will be having the conversation together about her work and particularly around rural practices, because she has curated for over 2.5 decades in such spaces. And Kubu is in a very beautiful part of the world, which is quite rural and can take a little bit of while to get to, is what I would say as well. It's about 2 hours from Helsinki on public transport. 2.5.
Three yesterday.
Three.
Okay, three.
Yeah.
I stand corrected. Just to orientate people. Okay, so first of all, welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Thank you
Yeah.
for asking me. And just to attest, it's so beautiful here. The weather is amazing, but it's the most incredible landscape. It's a real pleasure to be here. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah,
Yeah,
thanks for
great.
coming. So as I mentioned, the conversation sits within the wider program of the Garden and the Hedge, which opened on the 5th of June and runs till the end of August. And one of the aspects that we were interested in doing through these conversations were to speak to practitioners and curators, designers and artists whose work would resonate with the program. And as I mentioned, you've almost 2.5 decades of working as a curator. What brought you into that space? How did you start working as a curator?
Yeah, so I studied fine art and art history in Goldsmiths in London, and I think fairly quickly realized that I wasn't a very good artist. But I really enjoy working with other artists. I really enjoy working with, sorry, excuse me, people. And so kind of moved into a curatorial space. So my first real job was in Imperial War Museum in London. I actually wanted to work in the Victoria and Albert Museum because my interest was in applied art, but the job came up at the Imperial War Museum. So I've had that kind of big institutional experience as well. But moved around. I moved to I'm Welsh, I'm from North Wales. I moved back to Llandudno in North Wales to work in the main exhibition space in North Wales called Mostyn. So moved kind of out of a huge organisation into quite a small one, and really enjoyed that kind of hands-on working with artists, working with objects. And then I moved to Winchester to work in Winchester School of Art, but running a touring exhibition service out of the Winchester Gallery then. Then it was nearly now, but I worked for the British Council, so I toured British art overseas for 3 years. And in between all that, I did my master's in museum and gallery management. So got some kind of sense of theory behind what I was doing. And then I've had a freelance career basically for the last 25 years, working on and off in Winchester School of Art and teaching. So yeah, that's me. And I've really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed the kind of freedom of being a freelance worker as well. It's really precarious. And it's a bit scary at times, but yeah, it's been really interesting.
Thanks for that kind of overview. I think it really helps to sort of position all the layers and institutional practices that you've been involved in, and also now as program lead for the MA in curatorial studies at Winchester. One of the things and one of the reasons that we sort of connected was Khubu is situated in on an island, Kemiotone, which has a population of approximately 7,000 people in the normal span of a year, but then bumps up to almost 25,000 plus in the summertime. But most of the work is situated in developing cultural experiences for the local community. So it works both in terms of being a space where people can come and show their work, local artists and national artists, as well as having a community program. This year created almost the first sort of explicit international program. And as part of that, Tuomo Ansari, who the directors and co-founders of Khubu, have been, I guess, for anyone that works in rural spaces, coming up to those, questions of what it means to curate contemporary work in remote places. And you have been doing this over the last couple of decades, particularly also in Wales. What do you see as some of the, I guess, positives of working in such places?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think, in a sense, when you're the only game in town, the only cultural game in town, you can play a different kind of game. And it's really important to keep your audience, to keep your participants involved. So to be, I mean, not necessarily consultative, but to program with your local audience in mind. So I think maybe you have a kind of responsibility to engage, maybe expand people's definitions of what's possible and what's art and what's culture, but also to acknowledge local practice and certainly local artists, like people who are producing locally. I think that's really important, and to acknowledge the kind of materials they're using, whatever that is, even if it's digital or material or connected with rural practice. I think that can be a unique selling point for your venue. So there's an old adage which reads, if a man maketh a better mousetrap than his neighbor, then the whole world will beat a path to his door. And even if he lives in the middle of a forest, the whole world will beat a path to his door. My father used to say it a lot. I do love it. It's about being very specific, being very attuned to local needs. but also expanding those needs, yeah, and requirements.
I think at Kubu, that's one of the things that is a constant sort of balance between actually addressing all those like local issues, as you say, but then at the same time, bringing in that specialisms, beating a new path in a sense, and then kind of creating bridges to other international practitioners, which was really explicit about the program this year, that are not just working in rural contexts, but also addressing, you know, issues, I guess you could say, in terms of social practice, critical minerals, technology, all of these things are kind of foregrounded in the program. One of the things that's really particular about Kubu is that it was a former school, old school building, and in some ways is a sort of a heritage site, you could say, in on the island, in that many people have memories of coming to school here. And so when the local audience come, there's also this sort of storytelling that happens, like, oh, I remember doing that here, or I remember being taught by. You've also worked in heritage sites, like really formalized heritage sites in terms of National Trust in England. And what type of artist do you think is best suited then to, or what, maybe not so much an artist, but the skills that an artist needs to have to work in these sort of layers of place, rurality, heritage sites, or important local sites?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I worked with National Trust Wales in Wales, not England, and it was really important. So I worked on a 3-year residency program in a, actually a slightly, sorry, not slightly, very problematic property in North Wales called Penrhyn Castle. It had a very difficult history. So for a 3-year program, in the first year, we invited artists who, well, we tried to select artists who were really good communicators. It was as important to have people who could communicate with, actually, even in the first year, not even the audience so much. The priority was communicating with the volunteer workforce, well, the staff and the volunteer workforce within the property. So I knew from experience that that's a very specific kind of artist. So we had people who were, yes, they were good with materials, but they also had a kind of performative side as well. They could kind of play to the crowd. They were very, okay, I'll say it, they were very charming. They were very good at kind of working with people and bringing them on side to the project, which became really, really important, because if the first year hadn't worked, then the second year would not have happened, and the third year probably not. So it was a kind of cumulative process. It was really interesting appointing those artists in that they were not really expected to kind of produce anything. They were not expected to produce an exhibition, for example, which is quite unusual for a residency program. It was only for a month. It's ended up being longer because people wanted to stay longer. But they did a show, because that's what artists do. They make things and they want to show an audience, which they had understood more by that point. Mm-hmm. They wanted to show what they'd been making, mm-hmm. what they'd been working with during that period. So that was really interesting to me, like to appoint people who were there really just to provide kind of conversation and to expand people's understanding of what an artist can be, that they're not necessarily making material things, but they kind of came up with everything. I mean, they did such a good job. They were so compelling, so convincing. And we were talking yesterday with some of the artists here, and the line came up about site sensitivity, not site specificity. And I think that kind of sensitivity and an openness to conversations about site and recognizing something about a site, which is, you know, not, it's, site specificity is so, it's too narrow a term. And I think that a kind of open-mindedness to what's possible in a site, and working with people, you know, there's a kind of generality about that, which is also kind of quite delicious. It's quite a nice conversational, discursive kind of approach to performance, art production, so that it can be sensitive to and informed by a site, but not necessarily specific. But as our residencies progressed, the stories became more and more specific, actually, to the history of the site, and helped address some of the kind of problematic issues around that site, which was based on, sorry, just to give you some background, based on the history of slavery, which is where the money came from, and then very harsh industrial relations practices to do with a slate quarry in North Wales. So it's about an extractive history in North Wales.
And an industrial revolution by the workers, which would then ended up becoming almost a template for other.
For other strikes, So it was the site of the longest strike in British industrial history. It was a 3-year strike, which affected, you know, talk about kind of social effect, it affected all the locale hugely, and became a kind of template, yes, for industrial action. And I'm sure kind of informed the miners' strike, the 80s miners' strike, but this was, you know, in 1900 to 1903. But the effects of that strike and the kind of social divisions in the communities that it happened in, they are still active today, you know, more than 100 years later. It's really interesting. It's really interesting kind of social, it was a sort of social wedge, which hasn't quite gone away. But this project did something to softens people's attitude to this local property, which before was just visited by tourists and National Trust members going into. So for those who don't know, National Trust is our heritage organisation. It has cafes. A lot of people go for the cafe and the cake and the gardens, and they're quite happy to not really engage with the kind of real histories of the site. I think National Trust doesn't help itself in that it writes the histories of a place in a very, very even kind of way. I mean, they don't really make, until now, they haven't really made distinctions between one history and another history. So, yes, it was a kind of marketing exercise also for the National Trust. It really did help expand the relationship with the local audience.
I mean, that example just like hits so many complex points. And in the build up to this conversation, you know, we've had a few rounds of like thinking through some of those things because, you know, if you wanted to be on one level really hypercritical, are these practices like sort of art washing particular histories? And we talked about that, and we talked about what this softening is and how do you sort of like work to address in a restorative way. There's restorative justice, one could argue, that's actually happening in that kind of particular process, but how do you bring a community then on that journey, bringing it back then to, I guess, the histories of Kemiotone and the island here in a way, which is part of the broader, as I mentioned, you know, Baltic Sea region. And last night again, you know, we were speaking to artists that are present here in the exhibition, just referencing Calais here as credit to his sensitivities and sensibilities in terms of sight. And then Anna, who was working here with local dyes and color practices related to that, but are deeply like rooted into kind of questions of like landscape, borders, enclosures, knowledge systems that were like wiped and represented and repackaged. Where I'm getting to really is you're also an educator and an educator of, you know, the next generation of curators. You mentioned communication as a key skill. You mentioned performativity and ability to kind of connect to staff and volunteers. What else do you sort of see as like critical capacities, maybe, that we need to be thinking together around, both as practitioners, both as people trying to do this work at Kubu, you as an educator? What are the other skill sets that you think might be kind of like underlining these kind of
Yeah,
directions at this moment in time?
I think part of it is kind of recognizing what's here already, and recognizing the strengths of the people who work here, who are kind of meshed together, trying to make something really creative, really connective happen. And you mentioned the rural. I think one of the kind of strengths of a rural community, and this is quite an interesting one for me because it's quite like Wales in that it's agricultural, and my background is agricultural, but also post-industrial, which involves skills, doesn't it? Manual skills, working with others, collaboration, management, working with materials. I think kind of recognizing that heritage is really important. Even if it's translated into different manifestations of that, through bringing artists in an artistic practice. I think there's, having worked in galleries which are based in rural communities, there's a kind of recognition of those kind of skills. That's a really good hook to get people engaged.
But the
I think
part,
maybe I haven't answered your
no,
question.
it's I think it's actually about again awareness and sensitivity to awarenesses of what is already there, which I think the time frames, that's what we're, I mean, I've also been working in rural contexts in Ireland and going back to the village that I grew up in and working there, and the time frames that you might be used to in working in urban spaces and then working in rural places, the time it is at a different beat, yeah, and finding those people are at a different beat, and you have to sort of like adjust to those things really in a way, because not everything maybe pops up in the most kind of quick immediate way that might be present like in a large city where there's maybe an abundance of such producing skills and marketing skills and technical skills and so forth.
I think the we've touched on it before, but the kind of conversational preparation for activities is more important in a rural setting than in an urban setting, in that you in any kind of discourse around practice informs the artist, the kind of interviewer, and the audience kind of prepares an audience for what might happen. So I think time, yeah, it's a really interesting point about time, about spending that time in research before delivery. So, which kind of hints at a sort of residency model, which I think has been really successful here, from what I've heard, and allowing people time to really kind of understand where they are, get their feet under the table, be a really kind of good fit, and also to listen. I think there's a lot talked about co-creations, and in the UK, which doesn't have to be quite the way it sounds. It can just be about kind of listening and assimilating elements of a culture. You're never going to kind of drop into a place and completely understand it, but you can kind of pick something up, and it's like kind of making a tapestry or something. You bring something of the texture of what you do to a place, but you're also taking something of that texture with you. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting.
I think it wraps around back to sensibilities and sensitivities, and it makes me think of that million-dollar question around funding and like how do you sort of, again, build those timelines and timescales, and I call it the breadcrumb effect, that you build up slowly, like you maybe have an opportunity to support someone to come for a weekend and then or a day or a visit, and you try to hold that as best you can, or maybe it's a week, and that allows then this gentle kind of accumulation in a sense that needs to kind of happen, I think, in order to bring communities that are dispersed, because it's like people are not like in cities where hyper located and on top of each other. So actually, the messaging, yeah, that needs to happen actually has to also take longer to kind of stew in a way. So
There's an interesting model in the UK, which sadly doesn't exist anymore, but there's a gallery that was built, kind of redeveloped in the New Forest, in the south of England, And the gallery was called Artsway. And their model was, yeah, I think there's quite a lot to kind of share with the model of practice here, in that they were sort of behaving like a publicly funded gallery on that kind of circuit of publicly funded galleries in the UK. And they did so on that level, but they also strove to make much deeper relations with artists and sustained relationships with artists. Because I think there's a kind of habit of, so this month we're working with this artist and then they disappear and then we move on to the next artist. And that kind of continuity is broken. But they set up an artist associate scheme and they brought their probably mostly local audience along with them. And they would arrange studio visits, they would sustain longer relationships, including. And it sort of evolved into something called the Artist Agency, run by the ex-director of Artsway, because Artsway kind of folded, lost its funding, who now runs something. Yeah, the Artist Agency supports artists in that it works with them. It is just him, really. It's just him. Works with artists to write bids, because artists aren't necessarily that good at writing their own bids. They need maybe really specialist support in getting public funding, but then writing in project management fees. So it's a kind of self-supporting organization. But the model of the artist associate, which is a bit more like private practice if you think about it, it's a bit like having a stable of artists who you work with, maybe on a 2-year cycle, then it's their turn to have a solo show. That was happening in a publicly funded gallery. You can argue against it easily. Exclusive as well as inclusive, but in terms of building a relationship between a community of artists who didn't necessarily know each other that well and the local community, it was really super successful. And it also brought in a local, not our university, but a local university to work with them on that project when it was in Artsway. Yeah, it's super interesting, and it's kind of sad that it didn't survive, but as a model, I think it's a successful one.
And I guess they're models of production in a sense that we have a fab lab maker space, we have expertise here in particular, I would say open hardware hacking, and working and drawing artists that actually are doing that type of work, but that intersect with pedagogy and education and community, while at the same time also producing work that can sit in a white cube gallery. So this already is very specific in some of like what we can offer also at Kupu. I kind of want to move on a little bit because there's two things before we sort of wrap that I wanted to touch upon. And one was your expansive experience also in volunteers and working with volunteers. And this is also a very particular thing, I think, with also, well, many organizations these days, and it is a skill set in its own right. It is actually to work with volunteers. We have a large sort of senior organization, let's say cohort, and who are interested in working in that kind of capacity, and also but also interested in like how we can tie. How we can develop that with younger members of the community and others who might even want to be open to sort of like a professional switch, but they haven't yet the context to do that, but they might want to move into, let's say, production, or they want to test out some sort of design or print or so, there's a concentration again of expertise or craft, yeah, that's here. And what's your thoughts on that? Yeah, could you share your experience or the tips maybe that might be useful?
Tips. I'm not sure about tips. I think it's really interesting working with a volunteer workforce because they are, well, they're people who have the time to do it. So probably they have the leisure time. Maybe they're retired. I don't want to make assumptions. So they have skills. They have a lot of skills. They bring skills with them. What I always say to students working in groups is, the first thing you do is to do a skills audit, like who's in the room, what skills do they have, what can they contribute, and how can one member of that cohort support others to increase their skills. And I'm sure it's happening here, but maybe it also needs articulating that that's a possibility. Yeah, and that's
Yeah.
that volunteers really need to get something out of it for themselves, otherwise they
Mm.
don't turn up. And maybe that's a sense of
Mm.
community and contributing in a different way to a community, because they've probably been doing that before in an organization or in a social setup in a different way. So it's about translating that potential for input into a different cohort, and then it's also extractive. They get something out of it, which is
So
a kind of satisfaction.
I'm really interested in how we can change the language of these things, because like audits and inputs
Yeah,
and
sorry.
wait, again, it's stuff that we've been talking about also in because we have been layered with a new liberal language in the arts that now start to kind of like filter so deeply into the normative way to talk about things that I'm very conscious in kind of hosting and holding conversations over the last couple of months, particularly around social practice, that it flows off the beat of our tongues, even though I know that our hearts are not there, you know? And it's actually, I think that that's one thing that I think is part of the reimagining. No, not even reimagining already sounds a part of that discourse in a sense, but I think there has to somehow be another way to speak about this, particularly in times of crisis in the arts, where art and design schools are struggling, and also funding is getting cut, and institutions are getting, you know, closed, and therefore the kind of economic discourses that we have to perform, in a way, and that's what's happening is in these ways. So we don't have to answer all of that, like today.
No, but we're lucky in that in various ways we kind of call ourselves curators, and the origin of the term is in care, and there's been quite a lot recently written about curating as care, which is useful. I think it's a really useful way of thinking about it. So, you know, as we both work now for a big university, we spoke the other day about being good neighbors, being part of our community, how, you know, however small that is, whether it's just the kind of the occupants of the houses near where we work, where we kind of check in every day, or part of the city or the region or nationally. So that kind of contribution, I think, kind of recognizing that we have something to offer in terms of caring. Yeah, so we can switch this corporate language to, you know, I mean, I'd love to switch it to kind of hippie, let's love each other, caring kind of language. I think it would be useful. And yeah, let's switch out.
Nice. Okay. I think that's like one of the takeaways then that we can have to start to champion that. So we, again, going back to your own experience and something that's very present here in Kubu is the I would say the complexity and the richness. And again, I know we keep saying to the conversations that we had last night, because you arrived last night into Kubu, and you know, we're lucky to be here present with some of the other artists that I mentioned that were sharing their you know, knowledges and wisdoms and understandings of their own culture, which of course came to the fore was language. Yeah. And in at Kubu, there's a commitment to always work in Finnish and Swedish in terms of the comms, which is very unique also to this part of Finland. And in terms of an international exhibition, and also then working with an international cohort, English then gets thrown in. So, you know, you're a small arts organization, and then you're having to do these like really extensive pieces of work around comms, marketing, and translation. And coming from Wales, there's also that commitment to bilingual expression and sharing. Again, it's not so much about tips, but it would be great to hear your experience of that, and maybe more on time frames, because again, it's a lot of effort and it's a lot of work, and it would be really interesting to hear what you have learned from that process also.
Yeah, so definitely in Wales, everything is published bilingually, and it's You know, we all know it's a kind of design nightmare because everything is really long. The type gets smaller. If you're over 43, you need, you know, glasses to see it. But it is really important. I think, I mean, certainly in Wales, there is a kind of slight disconnect sometimes between printed Welsh and the kind of spoken Welsh. And so when texts are translated, they tend to be translated by people who work in universities, who write for other people in universities. So there's a kind of a bit of a disconnect there. Maybe it happens here too, no idea. Yeah, but it is really important, you know, even if only four. So there's a kind of, yeah, there's a design question in that. Do you have parallel bilingual, trilingual texts? Do you have that kind of book that you flip over and it's like a, it's a version of itself, but it's upside down, and then it meets in the middle, like that's crazy. Or, you know, in Wales, there has been a kind of tradition of printing separate catalogues, so not having those parallel texts. But I know that because the readership, the actual readership of Welsh texts is smaller. Lots of institutions have a back room just full, well, everyone has a back room full of catalogues anyway. Maybe they have more Welsh ones than English ones, but it's still really, really important to do. It's about representation. And actually, just going back to care, it's about caring for the culture that we operate in, about just kind of recognizing, you know, the kind of power of that actually, and the distinctiveness of where we're operating. So, you know, if we're talking about site sensitivity, that's the kind of ultimate sensitivity, catering for people who are more comfortable reading in the medium of Welsh or Finnish or whatever. And then, you know, the international art language of English, it's very, very good for people who don't speak other languages. Yeah, so yes, it's important.
How did you manage that actually in the British Council with maybe even not just dialects, but like perhaps a location that had like four or five languages that were like, let's say, core to the country's identity?
Yeah, to be honest, I only ever worked on projects which had two for the British Council. And there were, yeah, it was dealt with in one of two ways. So either parallel texts or a separate catalogue in the local language. But they tended to be, you know, they weren't kind of minority languages also. They would be in Spanish, or, you know, sorry, I did a lot of work in Latin America, so it was Spanish. But, you know, if there's budget, it's all possible, but it's time, isn't it? It does take a lot of time to get that text right, to like it's just doubling, tripling up. I don't know how you manage here. And also in design terms, you know, it's a lot more work. But really important. And, you know, why are we publishing things if we, unless, if we can't do that? It seems really important.
And I think it goes back to also world making in a sense. And if you do want to care, hold, think about sensitivities and sensibilities, that world that you create. And in a way, one of the, I think, beautiful things about Kubu, because of its remoteness, it is a world. We're creating a world inside a world, inside a world, inside a world. And therefore, you know, you have this, you start to kind of like hold values and commitments, and that then starts to become you know, a bit the heartbeat of the operation, in the sense that starts to create the trajectory in the world, then that becomes more fuller and richer as you kind of go on.
I think it's really interesting. The other kind of parallel organization that springs to mind, and did when I arrived yesterday, is Ruthin Craft Centre in North Wales, which is the main craft gallery in Wales. And how the director, Philip Hughes, who's just retiring now, but for the last 20 something years, has carried, literally carried the local audience along with, you know, kind of more and more ambitious projects, has kind of developed the audience appetite for more ambitious things, but also retained. And I think the retail area here is interesting in that it stocks locally produced items. And serves as a, you know, as a marketplace, as a meeting place, and a kind of acknowledgement that there is really, really local activity. and really local production. But just going back to Ruthin Croft Centre, I think they have done such a good job because they're the main craft space in North Wales, sorry, in Wales. They used to take communities of artists and artists' work to international art fairs, so including SOFA in Chicago. They used to go to events in London. So they're kind of representing Wales because they were Welsh artists, but on an absolutely level playing field with, you know, international art practice. So has actually kind of put Wales on the map. It's taken years, put Wales on the map in terms of high level craft practice in that kind of particular, you know, kind of studio craft practice. Really thorough, but also just kind of taking the audience along with that process. They haven't left them behind at all. They feel included. And like here, they have a cafe, it's a meeting place. It's a retail area. It's a place, you know, it's so busy just before Christmas because everyone's stocking up for kind of Christmas presents. So, and it's a destination for people from England as well. It's kind of near enough to the English border. So it's near the kind of industrial areas like Manchester, Liverpool. So it's a part of a day out in North Wales. Yeah. So it's kind of done all those things very cleverly, slowly, thoroughly, with care. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it's creating destination spaces, isn't it, really, in some ways?
Yeah.
I want to sort of turn a little bit to kind of more your own research, deep research work that has been expressed in a way through your curatorial practice. And we spent the morning almost talking about this, which was great to learn more about. But you have combined this, you know, working in rural places with craft practices, heritage sites, but more really specifically around metal and copper.
Yeah.
And we're part of a 5-year elemental threads is the name of the program, with this year focusing on soil, next year on water, wind, metal, fire. Those two sort of elements are interchangeable, and then ether. What, again, we're in this post-industrial, I mean, when I say post-industrial landscape in Clubu, it's like the ironworks here now are medieval and more modern, but specifically around questions of minerality and copper being almost, you know, the defining mineral of technology and digital society in a way. Could you speak a little bit about what work you've done in that field and also where you are now or where you'd like to go with your research on that topic?
Okay. Yeah, so a couple of really interesting researchers in Camberwell School of Arts in, so I'm going back, I'm starting at the very beginning, in the late 80s, studied the effects of patination on metals, including copper, largely including copper and silver. And they published a kind of, it became a kind of recipe book for anybody working in studio practice or industrially. And my Irish colleague, Dr. Colleen O'Doul, he's kind of taught all over the world and he's worked in workshops in India, in Korea, in China. He says there was a copy of this book, this British produced Thames and Hudson book, on the shelf. It's the kind of Bible of patination. So 10 years after that was published, I'd been observing that people were working with metal in a completely different way because it became easy for them to change the colour of metal for, well, architectural applications, but also studio metalwork and jewellery. So in 1993, working with the Southern Arts Touring Exhibition Service in the Winchester Gallery, my colleague John Gillett, we did an exhibition for Crafts Council, which toured the Winchester Gallery and then toured the UK, called The Chemistry Set, which was about that kind of coloration. And then 20 years later, I collaborated with Dr. Colleen O'Doul on the kind of follow-up from that, which was called What Color is Metal, which kind of followed changes in practice to do with difficulties with extraction, political difficulties with extraction, sustainability issues in disposing of materials which are particularly liquids which are produced through sun patination techniques. And we put together an international show, which was hit by COVID. It took a long time to deliver, but showed in Ireland and in the Winchester Gallery, showed in the Winchester Gallery in 2022. I've always been interested in that area. I'm part of a research group in Royal College of Art, the material engagements sort of research cluster, partly because a lot of the people who were in the, actually both shows in some cases, and the original researcher, Michael Rowe, they're in that group. So I kind of got in there. So I'm hoping to extend that to, the next show, but just to kind of focus on copper in particular, the kind of industrial applications of copper, the kind of newer applications of copper, issues around that, but also to focus more, to kind of bring the two strands of my research together, which, is partly to do with place and actually working in rural settings, working in Wales, recognising kind of my own cultural background. Maybe focusing on some areas of copper extraction, which, is kind of a political, maybe it's a sort of dead political argument in Wales, but it's kind of worth exercising working with other kind of edgelands communities.
Kind of feels like it loops back anyway to some of those, industrial strikes and, extractions that perhaps are historical, but, do get played out in other countries that,
then it's happening all the time. It's happening right now.
And then we have, of course, colleagues that are looking at this question of critical minerality in various different ways in their work. We're sort of coming, I guess, to a close with the conversation, and I just wanted to sort of bring it back to, and hopefully we'll be able to continue a conversation with you around the work in metal in the future. But what you sort of see, I guess, as potential for Kubu, particularly for young curators who might be coming in, because we're really keen to support those that are emerging in their practice to kind of see the site and the space as an opportunity for their work. What do you think would be necessary, in a sense, to kind of create as an organization to support that or scaffold that, and what's your feeling or sense of that in terms of some of, even with your own students in mind?
I think there's so much potential here. I think we spoke earlier about the need to kind of embed, to be here, to understand what this place is like. And I've been here less than 24 hours. I'm speaking like I know it, and I really don't. I think the kind of residential model is a really good one, because it allows for the time, which we referred to earlier, for that kind of to cook, for things to happen, for observations to be made and conversations to be had. So I think that kind of opportunity, opening it out to younger or early career, doesn't necessarily mean the same thing, curators to find their feet and understand that it's possible to operate in a really interesting way in a rural area, that you don't need to be looking at capital cities the whole time, and heavily funded spaces which are quite actually inaccessible to young curators. So as far as my own students is concerned, I mean, I'm really interested in continuing the conversation about how we collaborate, because my students are largely international students from mainland China. I think the kind of mineral extraction kind of history is really pertinent to them. They may not know it because they're from really big cities. I think it might be quite a shock to come here and kind of see what it's like to be in the countryside. But I think there's a lot to sort of talk about around that, and also a challenge for them to be presenting the work of artists to a rural specialist destination audience also. So I'm really excited in pursuing that conversation.
I guess the elemental theme also then resonates twice
perfect
with Chinese culture as which is.
So I think some of the most successful group projects that we've had in the past from my program have been exploring that relationship between, you know, the kind of Western understanding of, I don't know, cultural artifacts or minerals in this case, and the Eastern one, and, you know, where that meets in the middle and their understanding or their changing recognition that there are, you know, two channels. Very, very fascinating. I genuinely think they'd have a lot to offer.
Mm.
I think they need to be kind of talked into it in quite a gradual way.
Mm.
I think a visit would help if it was possible. Maybe this is kind of an impossible dream, but I think it would help. Yeah. Mm.
No, it's good. It's good to hear, you know, what you sort of see as, like, in some ways, both meaningful connections, but then also the very practicalities, as you say, of costs and distance and cultural facilitation and supports that need to kind of happen. And I think, again, going back to what we're trying to produce or trying to cultivate here, these longer lines of things, like, they will take time. It doesn't all have to land in, you know, ASAP in a way. These are sort of small increments in a sense, but it, you know, we're trying to also think through how to connect to Finnish educators as well, of course, that are in that space. But it's also just interesting from your perspective from another country to kind of hear those potential connects.
I think there's quite a lot of connections between Finland, I know Finland and Japan, but Finland and China now also, cultural connections. I think maybe they can be exploited, certainly looked into. I mean, my graduated students tend to go back to China, and I think it's very difficult to get jobs, genuinely difficult to get jobs. They are largely working in the private sector, so they'll be working in galleries which are in shopping malls, and they are a kind of adjunct to very, very commercial settings. So that's why I'm saying this is quite a shock to them. They're only on a one-year program. They're with us for 1 year. So I also have to ask myself, like, how translatable are these skills? But I think they are translatable because of the care issue, actually, because it's also about looking after the producers. It's looking after the artists, finding the right artists for the right venue. And I think this would be a really kind of active, good learning on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there'd be a lot to explain to kind of set that up also,
mm-hmm.
which is my job and maybe your job.
Thank you. So we've got 5 minutes of the conversation left. I'm just going to check in with our online audience to see if there is any burning questions that you might have. Do drop them into the chat. And otherwise, I actually will break convention and see if there's a question from the floor that actually might resonate. Otherwise, we can close a little bit earlier in the conversation. The rest of the afternoon here at Kubu, we will be doing a gallery tour with people that are passing through and locals in the next week, the next sort of month. The activities include Andrew Patterson doing his Worm VJ Clue event. We have the Norpass Music Festival coming up, which is a collaboration with a regular music festival that happens here every year at the end of July, beginning of August. We have the artist Paul Grandjean, who will be visiting at the end of August as our final artist in residence that is coming for a week here. Paul's work, Mud Machine, is also showing in the gallery as part of the Garden and the Hedge. And we have colleagues from the Centre of Social Microbes at the University of Helsinki who will be leading workshops on fermentation and looking at the seasons in relation to fermentation practices as well. That is Will LaFleur and Maya, whose surname escapes me right now. But these are our workshops that are coming up across the next month. Tune in to the next Friday hybrid conversation, which will be with Paul Grandjean, which is at the end of August. So it's Friday the 29th or 27th, I can't remember, but the last Friday in August. Same time, we will share that, and Paul will be speaking about his work actually on soil and mud and the kind of playful instruments, machines that he makes to look at like even the impossibilities of generating soil. So it connects very much to questions around soil degradation and environmental waste that comes from technology. Then all the remaining parts of the program will be physically here at Kubu, but I have dropped the link into the chat. I'm just going to repeat it again in case you came in late into the program, into the room, and you happened had a chance to look at it. And yeah, I think, Sarah, I would just like to say thanks so much for joining us and sharing such a wealth of experience in terms of working, as I mentioned, in rural places, heritage sites, and also with voluntary organizations in bilingual contexts. I think it's an ideal kind of conversation to have with somebody as experienced as yourself, really. In, you know, Kubu is just starting up still in a way. It's 4 years old, with this year almost being the first international program. So we're really at the beginning of a journey. And thanks so much for sharing your practice and enjoying having you here in the next few days.
Lovely. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, it's very exciting. Yeah, very exciting to be here. Thank you.
And thanks everyone for joining us. We will, yeah, as I said, share the link to the final conversation with Paul Grandjean at the end of August. And thanks to those who joined us here in the room. Okay, cheers everyone. Have a good day and weekend. Thank you.